It's 9:09, and you're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. We're live 8 to 10 weekday mornings and rebroadcast 8 to 10 in the evenings on radio stations across Oregon and California. You can find all of our segments online at jeffexchange.org. And today is Monday, February 1st, 2016. I'm Emily Curitan. In this hour, an ambulance ride-along. Make that 1,000 ambulance ride-alongs. We see what it's like in the back with former paramedic Kevin Hazard. So coming up, the ins, the outs, and the dead ends of a very tough job. But first, a weather forecast from Jefferson Exchange Associate Producer Megan Mercier.
Hello. Today, the forecast for the Southern Oregon Cascades and Siskiyous is a slight chance of snow showers with a high near 30, a chance of snow with a low around 19 tonight. In Yreka today, a slight chance of snow showers before 10 a.m. today with a high near 41, a chance of rain and snow tonight with a low around 30. In Weed and Mount Shasta, mostly sunny skies with a high near 37 today. Tonight, a chance of snow with a low around 26. In Redding and Red Bluff, mostly sunny today with a high near 53, a chance of rain with a low around 37 tonight. In the Klamath Basin, partly sunny with a high near 33 today, a chance of snow with a low around 20 tonight. On the Southern Oregon coast, a slight chance of rain with some patchy fog before 10 a.m. today and a high near 48. Tonight, rain likely with a low around 40. On the Northern California coast, a chance of rain after 4 p.m. with a high near 53 today, rain tonight with a low around 41. In Roseburg and the Umpqua Basin, some patchy fog before 10 a.m. today with a high near 46. Tonight, increasing clouds with a chance of rain becoming mixed with snow and a low around 36. In Grants Pass, Medford, and Ashland, patchy fog and a slight chance of rain and snow showers before 10 a.m. today, otherwise mostly sunny with a high near 44. A chance of rain mixed with snow and a low around 33 tonight. And in Eugene and Springfield, some patchy fog before 10 a.m. today with a chance of showers after 10 a.m. and a high near 46. A chance of rain with a low of around 35 tonight. Back to you, Emily.
Thank you for that forecast, Megan. Looks like wintry weather conditions are back. I threw me for a loop a little bit last week when we had a few balmy days, but then that pressure dropped and the wind kicked up, dropping some hail on me actually yesterday, and woke up this morning to a dusting of snow in the Rogue Valley. So good to see it is February yet. Here on The Exchange, your comments and questions are always welcome. We're talking this hour about the memoir of a paramedic with the paramedic who wrote that memoir. Our phone number is 800-838-3760 or email us jx@jeffnet.org. So before medicine usually comes an emergency. Before the hospital, before doctors, before tests and treatments, there's a 911 call for an ambulance. There's been a fall or a car wreck, multiple gunshot wounds, stabbings, psychotic episodes, or maybe a new baby born into this chaotic world miles from the nearest hospital. When we call for help in our most vulnerable moments, the people who show up first are not doctors. They're paramedics and emergency medical technicians, or EMTs. Our guest was one of these first responders for nearly a decade in Atlanta. His new memoir is 1,000 Naked Strangers, a paramedic's wild ride to the edge and back. Fair warning, if you're squeamish about things like severed toes and death by broccoli, this might not be the segment for you. The book is unflinching about injury, but it's also filled with humor and pathos about a largely thankless job. The author worked primarily at Grady Hospital in Atlanta from 2004 to 2013. Before that, he wrote for newspapers and then briefly delivered them. His freelance journalism has appeared in Atlanta Magazine, Marietta Daily Journal, and Paste. He's the author of a novel, Sleeping Dogs, and today he and his family live in Hermosa Beach, California. Kevin Hazard, we're glad to have you on the program and welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, so this book, 1,000 Naked Strangers, I got to admit, I was riveted reviewing it because there is quite a bit of blood and guts to hold the attention of a rubbernecker like me. You describe the training that you got to become an EMT as common sense and 8 months of school. How did that prepare you to deal with people in their most vulnerable moments?
Well, I'm not sure how much an EMT program really trains anybody. And I say that because there's simply no way to do it. You know, if you look at an emergency room physician, you know, that sort of the person who's going to be making the ultimate decisions at the hospital, you know, if you were to become a doctor, you would have about 2 or 3 years, 3 years generally, of an internship where you'd be a resident, you'd be working under physicians. So though you've been to 4 years of medical school, you're still going to have 3 years where you'd be working under supervision. That's simply not possible with an EMT. And, you know, even though the EMT is a junior member, the paramedic has been through more school and is theoretically more experienced. You know, there's just no way to prepare yourself for that. So, you know, you memorize the anatomy and physiology, and, you know, they teach you various things about bandaging and, you know, CPR and the Heimlich, and you kind of get something of a crash course, but there's simply no way to prepare you for what that actually looks like. It's one thing to know the signs of a stroke. It's another thing to be kneeling on someone's bathroom floor and be able to see those signs and interpret them correctly and then know what to do and where to take them. So it's a tricky thing. And then, frankly, you know, it's just one of those jobs that, unfortunately, a lot of it has to be learned through experience.
You describe in your book, A Thousand Naked Strangers, about looking at the appendix of your EMT textbook on your first day and almost puking. Why'd you stick it out?
Yeah, I felt hopelessly overwhelmed in the beginning. I really did. And I was convinced that I couldn't do it. The presumption is that this is a really difficult job. And in order to do it, you have to be a certain type of person. And that is the case. It just wasn't the type of person that I thought. And so why I stuck it out, I think, is pretty similar to why a lot of people stick it out there. You have to enjoy those chaotic moments. You know, I one of my very first calls was this guy who it was very early in the morning, and he's mowing his lawn, and there's a slight slope, and the grass is wet and dewy. And so he pushes the lawnmower down, and he starts backing up the hill. And his foot slips and goes underneath the lawnmower. And when we got called out there, I found myself kneeling in the grass searching for remnants of this guy's toes.
Ooh.
And I couldn't help but say to myself, this is the best job in the world. You know, I can't believe that I'm here in this moment to do this. And you have to enjoy, because it's a different form of medicine. You know, you could become a PA or a doctor or a nurse, and but that is, you know, that's in a hospital. There's air conditioning and an HR office and desks and paperwork. It's orderly and organized.
Uh-huh.
EMS is the opposite of all that. And, you know, you have to enjoy making sense of that chaos. And that's why I stuck around. I found that I thrived in that environment. And I think a lot of the people who do stick around, they have it.
So they really came into relief for you on a freshly cut lawn searching for 3 severed toes. Do you ever find those toes?
No, unfortunately, they are lost to history, which, you know, must be very strange to look out your kitchen window and know that somewhere out there lie your own bones. But, we never found them.
So that's one of many calls that you would end up taking over the 10-year period. But before all this, you were a government reporter for a local newspaper, something like that. How did you make the shift from working at a newspaper to searching for people's toes or trying to save their lives in a variety of other circumstances?
Well, I had gone to the Citadel, which is a military college in South Carolina. And a lot of my friends had gone into the military. I thought about it, ultimately decided not to, and 9/11 happens, and my friends, you know, are sort of marching off to war. And, you know, I don't think that there's necessarily anything, you know, wonderful or romantic about it. People who return from that experience don't generally have a ton of positive things to say. But I knew, and they knew, that they were heading off into this big moment in which they were going to be tested on a very extreme stage. And you start to wonder to yourself, or at least I did, you know, had I made that decision, because these guys, you know, they all entered what essentially was a peacetime army, you know, and suddenly they found themselves in this huge moment. And, you know, I wondered, had I done that, would I be prepared for that? Would I be able to handle those moments? And, you know, history sort of suggests that I wouldn't.
We're talking with Kevin Hazard. He's author of A Thousand Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back. Kevin, and everyone out there. We'll be back after a short break to talk about the life of a paramedic based mostly out of Grady Hospital in Atlanta. Phone number and email address on the way. You are welcome to join this discussion. This is the Jefferson Exchange, and I'm Emily Curitan. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Kevin Hazard, author of A Thousand Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back. Kevin worked as a paramedic in Atlanta for over a decade. He joins us now, and you're welcome to as well. 800-838-3760 is the number, or email jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Kevin, when you completed that 8 months of training for an EMT, and as I understand it, you also went back for the additional 18 months to become a paramedic later on down the line, was it hard to get that first job out of training?
A little bit. You know, I don't know. I think it's every city's probably a little bit different, but the place that I wanted to work at most in Atlanta was Grady. And
why?
Grady is a really interesting institution, and it, you know, I guess in New Orleans they have Charity, New York has Bellevue. There are just some hospitals that have this mythic sense about them, and Atlanta's one of the few major cities left in the country whose EMS is run out of a hospital as opposed to being incorporated with the fire department. So if you want to work EMS in Atlanta, you have to be a Grady employee, and Grady is so revered and feared and mythological, and their EMS service is the same way. I mean, they cover the area's most dangerous places. Also, it's, you know, the sports stadiums and the high rises. I mean, it's the middle of everything. And that's where, if you work in Atlanta, that's where you want to work. That's, you know, that those are the people that everybody looks to as sort of setting the standard. And at the time that I started out, you had to have experience. So I walked in and they said, hey, I'm glad, yeah, good job finishing school. Now go work somewhere for a year and come back. And so I didn't have a plan B, and I didn't know who else to go work for. So I wound my way to a rather disreputable place where one of my first partners drank on the job, and it was not what I would have expected. What's that?
I said that ain't all right. The drinking. No. Yeah, we'll save it for those who read the book, but some colorful partners you had over the years. I mean, how many partners did you have in the 10-year period that you were based mostly out of Grady Hospital in Atlanta?
I probably had about a half dozen long-term partners, and then, you know, I had a good year and a half where I didn't have a regular partner, so every day I was working with someone different, which is sort of a frustrating experience because that means every day each call you run is going to be done in a different way. You know, there's a rhythm to EMS. There's a rhythm to a bad call. There's rhythm to different types of calls. And if you don't have any rapport working with somebody, every single day you've got to try to reestablish that rhythm in the hopes that you can do it before you get a really bad call together. You know, and there's some people you just don't get along with. So it can make for a long, long day. But I, you know, dozens and dozens of people through the years that I worked with.
And you use some terminology in the memoir. You describe some of your colleagues as either tourists, true believers, or killers. Can you talk about the differences there?
Yeah, I felt tourists were the people who got into it for every reason but the medicine. You know, emergency medicine is not blood, guts, adrenaline. Emergency medicine is a lot of things. And sometimes it includes those things, but often, you know, it's really more of a cerebral pursuit, you know. So there are people who got into it, though, thinking, like, man, there's going to be gunshots. Or there were people who flat out got into it saying, hey, you know, I'm a landscaper, and I need benefits, you know, and I need money in the off season. And, you know, or I had a friend who was sommelier, and that's how he got into it, was he needed benefits while he did, you know, what he was passionate about.
So the tourists are sort of stalwart in the sight of blood, but they're not really ideologically motivated, or they just need the extra cash, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, they're just sort of there. And they can. Some of them are great at what they do. Some of them are not.
It seems like a line of work where if you didn't care too much, it might actually help you get through the day or stay there a little longer.
Well, there's such a thing as, you know, professional detachment. And I think, you know, among the true believers, you certainly had that. These were people who were born and raised to be paramedics and loved it. And to be good at that job, you have to have a certain degree of detachment. You know, there's, if you've mangled your leg, I can't straighten it if I think too much about how much pain I'm going to cause you. I have to simply do it, knowing it's going to hurt you, but it's also in your best interest. And, you know, you just simply can't think too much about that. And so the best people, the ones who got into it for the right reasons and will work their entire lives in that career, they certainly had that. The flip side to that, of course, are the people that I sort of term killers. And these were people who, for one reason or another, were really burned out and became a danger to their patients. And perhaps that was because they got into it for the wrong reasons, or maybe they just weren't properly disposed to have, you know, to work emergency medicine, and they just got angry enough that they became careless.
Now, and, when you're partnered like with someone like that, what's your response? Or when you were partnered?
Hypervigilance.
Yeah.
You have to do not only your job, but make sure they don't do something wrong. You know, and some of them, you know, sometimes it was just they were, you know, sort of accidentally bad. And then some of them, you know, just had a bad attitude and weren't interested in helping. They were just interested in whatever is the easiest way out of the situation, which sometimes could be harmful for your patient, you know. So you got to, not only are you doing your job, but now you're kind of standing on them, either getting them to do their job or doing it for them. It's a frustrating experience.
Now, Kevin, a minute ago you talked about emergency medicine. It's not all blood and guts and adrenaline, though, of course, sometimes it is. How is it a cerebral pursuit? You know, do you have time to study your patients before you have to treat them in a situation where seconds are of the essence?
Yeah, that's sort of the paradox of the whole thing, is that's how you have to do it. And that's something I picked up watching doctors in the emergency room. I would look at the way they approached a patient, and it was very slow and calculated. They would listen to what everybody was saying. They would look at the patient. They would look at the readouts from the various vital signs that everybody was taking. And they would start to make decisions based on, you know, their own experience and the patient's presentation and their patient's history in medicine. And so they came at it very deliberately, whereas, you know, I think because of the sirens, sometimes, you know, novice medics had a tendency to come running in and just throwing drugs and procedures at a patient before really thinking through what could be happening. And so the ones who were really good at it, and the ones I tried to model myself after, you know, took a slower approach, you know, something of an investigative role where you say, all right, here are all the things that are going on. Here's what their world looks like. Here's how they take care of themselves. Here's some of the things that could be happening to them. So what do we think is a cause, and what do we think could be doing it? Because there are usually two or three things at any given time that could be at the root of your patient's distress. You've got to take a slow, measured approach.
We're talking with Kevin Hazard, journalist and memoirist, most recently of 1,000 Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back, about his experiences working out of Grady Hospital in Atlanta. Join our conversation at 800-838-3760 or email jx@jeffnet.org. Kevin, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around how you went from being the guy who had to choke back his vomit on the first day of class looking at pictures of dead bodies to this guy who's like gleefully crawling around in the grass looking for some severed toes in such a short period of time. In writing this memoir and trying to, I guess, add, you know, a timeline to all the details, like those toes that you remembered, did you get a sense of what changed in yourself and how you became a guy who's cool with looking for severed toes or doesn't get caught up in the adrenaline too much?
Yeah, you know, I think what it came down to is the belief that I could handle the moment. Before I got into it, when I was much younger, I witnessed an accident and panicked. And, you know, there was that kind of gets back to why I left reporting. I watched my friends head off to war, and the question out there was, could I handle that moment? And when I got into this, after having seen paramedics and firefighters through the course of reporting and becoming interested in the fact that here was something that I could do right here at home, that question remained. When I get to this moment and I have my opportunity, will I panic? And I think that was what created that incredible sense of anxiety. And as I started doing my, you do these kind of ride-alongs while you're in school, where they stick you on somebody else's ambulance. Having seen a few things and realized, okay, I'm not going to panic. I can at least try to use my training. To me, that set everything off. And there is something really intoxicating about knowing that, A, you're going to be called out to these incredibly difficult moments, but B, that you know you've done them before and have done them well. So not only will you get to do them, but knowing that you've handled that moment and that you are capable and can be counted on, it's just a great feeling, and it really settles your nerves, you know, that sense of self-confidence. Plus, there's just a matter of perspective. You know, if somebody were to you know, be hit by a car right now in front of my house, I'd probably be in a bit of shock. Mm-hmm. But when you're on an ambulance, there's an expectation that that's going to happen, and you are prepared to handle it. So you're kind of coming at it from a slightly different point of view.
I want to go to a call now. We've got Brad in Ashland on the line. Brad, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I'd like to chime in here with Kevin. I worked at a funeral home in Michigan, and at that time, the funeral home hearse doubled as a community ambulance, and so we were the ambulance service. And even though we didn't have much training, we did have white hats. A little cap and a white coat we could wear. And I ended up taking first aid training myself and becoming an instructor and finding myself fascinated with the whole realm of anatomy and physiology and people. And I got to do all kinds of things, including bringing people back after they were gone. And one guy was cyanotic. He was dead, but we did heart massage on him, and he turned pink even though he didn't revive. Caught a baby once, all that stuff. And the being on call and being the one expected to do something, I found to be very good for me, because I had to step into the situation and figure out what to do and then do it. And it became kind of one of the high points in my life, so I appreciate what Kevin has to say here.
Thanks for that, Brad. Perhaps a little disconcerting if you call for an ambulance and a hearse shows up, as in Brad's small community there. But it sounds like that feeling of being in control of yourself when all the world around you is falling apart is a pretty powerful one. Kevin, you have any response to Brad?
Yeah, you know, it's funny how many people start out that exact same way. And it is remarkable that the understanding that you can deal with this incredibly difficult thing, it's a good feeling, but it's also an empowering feeling. So you kind of keep pushing yourself farther. I guess it's in the way that, you know, a runner doesn't lower his mile time by a minute. He lowers his mile time by 10 seconds, by 4 seconds. And each time you go, if I can run it this fast, then perhaps I can push it a little bit farther. And next thing you know, you're 10 years down the road, and you've got this long career, and you realize how competent you've become. He mentioned that he started out on an ambulance. People forget that, on a hearse, that the first paramedics did not hit the streets until about 1970.
Wow.
So this field is really new, and there were a lot of places where the hearse was what you saw if you called for help. And it shows in the field itself. We're still kind of learning what we are and how to properly use us, how to train us, how to make us the best resource we can be.
So in the course of writing your own story, you researched the history of emergency medical services in the U.S.?
I did. My instructor was one of the first 6 medics in the state of Georgia, and he had these wonderful stories, and he started exactly like Brad did. He was working in a funeral home. They would embalm one night, transport the next. And so I started to look back and said, well, when did this begin? And, you know, there were sort of hints of people going out into the public to bring patients to the hospital that started, you know, about 150 years ago. And it sort of had slowly advanced through the years. But even in the U.S. in the 50s, 60s, generally speaking, if you called for an emergency, there would just be 2 drivers. You know, there was at one point in New York, you would get a doctor and a cop. There was a city where you might get a driver and a bottle of brandy.
If you were telling us about the early days of emergency medical services and how your teacher was actually one of the first medics in Georgia.
Yeah, nice to see somebody else's technical difficulties once in a while. I would never be able to run a board like that. Every city had kind of its own setup. And so I think Cincinnati might have been one of the first to really get an organized EMS system. Miami and Jacksonville, Florida, were the first to actually employ paramedics. And that was 1969. So prior to that point, you know, you would get some sort of attendant, cop, doctor in one city, like I said, bottle of brandy, this sort of random mishmash of people who would come out to get you, but there was no treatment. It was merely, we're going to rush out, we're going to grab you, we're going to drag you back in as quickly as we can. And as people began to realize through the course of the Vietnam War that there was a moment in the mid-60s where a study was done, and they realized that you were more likely to survive if you were shot in Vietnam than you were if you were hurt in the U.S. And the reason being, the guy, you know, in some Southeast Asian rice paddy had a medic sitting next to him.
Uh-huh.
The U.S. didn't. And that was the birth of paramedics, which changed everything. But like I said, it's so new that, you know, not only does the public not understand it, but the cities themselves have still not quite figured out how best to utilize the resource.
So you talk about the origins in the 1970s of EMS services. Was that related to vets coming back from Vietnam and people being trained as field medics and sort of applying that to where they lived?
Yeah, they kind of took that model. They passed a law in the 60s that said, okay, now you can practice medicine outside of the hospital. And so that was when that was sort of the legislation that opened a door for this. But they used that model of how they trained military medics, and they, of course, they used many of them coming back as people who had that level of experience to kind of step in and start filling that role and figuring out, okay, how do we build a career from something that doesn't exist?
Oh, well, amazing to think that before 1970, we had hearses going to pick people up in their darkest hours. We are actually going to go to that short break momentarily. Before we do, Kevin, I want to ask you, you mentioned getting control of your panic. What kind of call from a dispatcher still would trigger that flare of panic, like, oh, no, where are we going now?
I think the worst ones are the size and location of your patient. You know, if you have a patient who's in a really acute distress, who is 500 pounds on the third floor in the back bedroom, especially if you've been there before and you know how difficult it was, because unlike being in a hospital, the patient isn't there waiting for you. You know, EMS, you have to figure out everything, including how to get to and then get the patient out and bring them somewhere. And those are always the worst when someone is really swirling a drain and you have to decide how you're going to get them out and treat them. It can be very complicated.
Well, and it seems like a lot of pressure in a given moment. I want to ask you when we return about dealing with that pressure and dealing with your mistakes. We're talking with Kevin Hazard, author of 1,000 Naked Strangers, a memoir about a paramedic's wild ride to the edge and back. We will be back on the Jefferson Exchange with Kevin Hazard and you on the other side of a very short break. Thanks. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Emily Curitan, and our guest is Kevin Hazard. His new memoir details 10 years of riding around in ambulances in Atlanta, dealing with pretty much every case you can imagine. You want to talk about being a paramedic or what it's like to deal with a crisis? Give us a call, 800-838-3760, or email jx@jeffnet.org. Kevin, you were just talking about the kind of calls you'd get that might trigger a bit of panic, even in the coolest EMS customer, like, say, having to treat a 400-pound person on a third-story walk-up. How did you deal with situations where you couldn't help people?
You know, I think the one thing you've got to tell yourself is if you show up and you perform perfectly and this person lives, you are not solely the reason that person lived.
Mm.
And likewise, if you show up and perform perfectly, you are not solely to blame for that person's death. I mean, people live or die regardless of how well you do. So I think that's the first step, is understanding your role in it. And the second thing, honestly, sort of relates to the first, and that's, it depends on what happened. Did they not make it because you didn't do your job well? That's going to haunt you forever. You will never live down that moment. And one of the first pieces of advice someone ever gave me was, you know, don't second guess yourself, but know your job. And knowing your job sort of takes away the second guessing aspect. But knowing your job is of critical importance, because, you know, EMS, in some ways, it's kind of like being in three arm wrestling matches simultaneously. You're just simply always going to be outgunned, and you've got to figure out a way to move from one thing to another quickly, and get used to taking, you know, these small bites to try to eat this giant monster that's in front of you. And the first step to that is knowing your job and knowing how to handle those things, and then just being okay with multitasking, you know, and just taking each crisis as it comes at you and putting that one down and then moving to the next one. And, you know, what's going to kill my patient first? All right, let me start with that. And
right. You have a chapter in here. It's called First Do No Serious Harm. It strikes me that the EMT's job, you know, in some ways a doctor has a little bit more of a luxury than an emergency provider, and that they can sort of take refuge behind their oath to first do no harm and say, well, I'm just not going to do anything if it's going to make it worse. But an EMT or a paramedic really has to act. Is that what you found in your 10 years doing that job?
I mean, certainly, yeah, you find yourself in a precarious position of having to do something always when you're not always certain what there is to do. You know, you walk through the door and someone's bleeding profusely, that bleeding needs to be stopped immediately. Or if somebody is choking, that choking needs to stop, or an allergic reaction. Those first steps absolutely have to be taken. And then you have to figure out, okay, now that we've taken that, what started this and how can we fix it? And that was oftentimes our role in the whole thing, was to stop the immediate life threat and then bring them somewhere where modern science and medicine can figure out how we got here and where to go. And, you know, sometimes 24 hours later, there still wouldn't be an answer to what was happening. They were just sort of in something of a medical waiting period, you know, trying to figure out, okay, you know, like a holding pattern. Here we are, but how did we get here? Nobody's quite certain yet. We obviously don't have the luxury of tests, so you just had to take that first step and then move on.
And you mentioned that, you know, the professional detachment of, you got to do your job and not take all the blame or all the credit, no matter the outcome. But what about when you did make a mistake? I mean, it's something every human does. How did you handle that and move on with your job and your life?
Well, that's the hardest part. And I suppose that's the hardest part of life. You know, failure is a fact, right? But mistakes carry blame. And so that's a really, you know, that's a very tough thing to do. And, those, you know, I remember, you know, a handful of instances where, you know, I feel like we didn't treat a patient as well as we could have. I remember, a time or two where, you know, a mistake was made and somebody ultimately died, you know, or at least, you know, it wasn't like we made a mistake and killed him, but, you know, we didn't do all the things we could have and failed to save them. And, you know, I don't know that there's any way to deal with that. You know, it sort of rests with you. And anyone who's ever practiced medicine has been in that situation where you can feel everything slipping away from you and you just can't get a hold of it. And you never get a hold of it. And the patient just continues to stay sort of, you know, half step ahead of you. And you watch it happen and you think, man, if only we could have done this a little bit faster, mm-hmm. or if only we could have realized that a half second earlier, perhaps we could have changed the outcome. And, you know, that's just a reality of practicing medicine. Sometimes you're going to have to carry that doubt.
Let's go to a call. We've got Connie in Eugene on the line. Connie, welcome to The Exchange. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I've known a lot of people in a variety of high adrenaline type of jobs, and I'm wondering, there often or sometimes is a toll for people who have jobs like fire, police, paramedics, etc. And I wondered how you grounded yourself, how you kept, you know, the family's life or your own personal life separate from all the stresses and rush of being a paramedic.
Great question, Connie.
Thank you. That's a really good question, and I think it's an important one. And it's one that a lot of people never really find a good answer to. For me, it all came down to a good home life. You know, my wife and I have a very good relationship, and regardless of what was happening at work, I came home and there was, you know, there was love there, there was humor there, there was an escape. And it helped for me personally to be with someone who was not in the field and to try to hang out with people who were not in medicine. Now, other people find it to be the opposite. They feel as if they can't talk to someone who doesn't really understand what they're saying. And there's truth to that. It's hard to explain what it feels like, you know, to hold a dead child to someone who's never been in that situation. But, you know, for me, it was always the communication that I had with my wife, the relationship that we had, and knowing that regardless of what happened, that I could go home and probably upon walking through the door, you know, be put right in my place, you know, with her sort of sarcastic humor. And that was what worked for me. And I think for a lot of the people who really struggle, unfortunately for them, they don't have that. They don't have that wonderful support at home to understand that this is a difficult job that puts you through strange circumstances.
And we have a question here dropped off from a listener, Jeannie in Medford. It's on a bit of a lighter note for this type of work. Jeannie wants to know what it was like to deliver a baby.
Somehow simultaneously horrible and wonderful.
How so?
The delivery of a child is a long process. By virtue of what's happening in the field, it is always natural childbirth, so it's a painful process. It also has a tendency to be something of a messy process, and so you find yourself in somebody's, you know, living room, and they are delivering this child, and you are doing your best to assist and not get anything on you, and, you know, there's an entire specialty dedicated to delivering children, and they do it in a much, much better environment than, you know, two guys kneeling on the floor, you know, hoping and praying that the baby comes out with 10 and 10 and a big smile. So the run-up to the delivery itself is a very, you know, just this sort of horrible thing where you really wish you weren't there.
How many deliveries are we talking here over your 10-year career as a paramedic?
I did a couple dozen, which...
Wow!
I was this unlucky person in that most people did not have that. Most people had far fewer. You know, I just happened to be the one that was always there. But once a child is born, it's wonderful, you know. Then everybody's... Yeah, you know, there's this new child that's in the room, and everybody's laughing and happy because it is joyous. But up to then, you know, I remember my first, like it was yesterday, accidentally pierced the woman's water, and it made a mess. I mean, it was a complete disaster. But it worked out. The child came out and was healthy and perfect, and you know, she of course did all the work, and we did all the looking.
So a call like that, would that make it a fun day at work? Were there fun days during all these years that you were running an ambulance?
Yeah, there certainly were. And calls like that, they are fun. You know, there's something that's hard to explain, and it's that all the madness that goes on, as a provider, you have to find the levity in those moments. You have to find some enjoyment in somebody else's horrible moment. And as strange as that sounds, how else could somebody do this job for 2 years, 10 years, 25 years, if they felt that tragedy with the same level of gravity that you did? It would be impossible. They simply couldn't do it. So you have to be able to find the humor in these moments, you know, sort of the pinprick of light at the far end of the tunnel. And, you know, because there's quite simply not enough of those adrenaline moments. A lot of it is conversation with people and the human connection between you and somebody else and the trust that they place in you, and, you know, by exchange the affection that you feel for them, because their outcome sort of rests in your hands to a certain degree. And
did people tend to trust you in these Atlanta neighborhoods? You're coming in on sirens with the uniform on. would people willingly put their lives in your hands right off the bat?
It's shocking to the degree to which they did. The way people would open their lives to you and open themselves to you, and whether it was, you know, disrobing in front of strangers or just allowing you in to ask, you know, really probing personal questions, or handing you their sick child. The level of trust was shocking. And, you know, I wasn't from Atlanta. You know, I'm a white guy from New York. A lot of the people that we worked with, you know, there was, you know, now you're with a black woman from the South. We don't theoretically have a connection, but in that moment, we are connected by the details of that call. And there's an incredible amount of trust, and that is it's a wonderful thing. I don't know of anywhere else where two people from totally disparate worlds can find themselves in this moment where they trust and need one another completely. And, you know, it's an incredible honor to find yourself in that spot. And the way in which people open themselves up, I always found very humbling.
Mm. So you moved on in 2013, is it? Why'd you decide to hang up the scrubs or uniform, whatever you guys wear?
You know, essentially because I felt that I'd reached a point where my empathy had receded to where I was no longer effective, and it wasn't good for me and it wasn't good for my patients. You know, you see a lot of things in this job, and the hours and the conditions and being outside all the time, and you know, those things all start to take a toll on you after a while, and it takes a very special person to continue decades later to love the job. And you know, I found that the frustrations were beginning to build up, and that starts to manifest in the way you treat people, the way you treat your patients, the way you look at the world, you know. And I just felt that my outlook was kind of getting a little bit darker. I didn't have the same level of empathy that I did prior. I wasn't able to get up for those big moments in the way that I had been. And it just felt as if my time had come. You know, I can stick around, but I can sort of see the writing on the wall, and I'm going to become one of those angry and bitter people.
Mm.
And so before that happened, I walked away.
So it sounds like knowing when to bow out in this line of work keeps you from, you know, keeps a true believer from becoming a killer or something like that and burnout. Did people give you the hero treatment when they found out what you did while you were a paramedic in Atlanta?
Yeah, you know, you get some of that. Some people are totally indifferent, and you get the opposite, which is, you know, oh, well, you know, whatever, you're the ambulance driver. And then, of course, the flip side of that is this sort of over earnestness that people show, and you know, oh, you guys are, you know, thank you for what you do, and it's wonderful that someone would say that. But you know, I would try to remind people, hey, you know, it does take a certain type of person, but it doesn't take, you know, a hero. It just takes someone who can handle these moments. And I, you know, that's sort of the way you see it on TV. The way that paramedics are portrayed, they're either, you know, at the end of a Bruce Willis movie, you know, just sort of these faceless people who jump in the ambulance as he slaps the doors and the ambulance drives off, or they're these, you know, tear in the eyes rescuers who are pounding on someone's chest saying, no, tonight you're not going to die. Not on my watch. I didn't find either of those to be true.
Yeah, a bit of a truer portrait of what it's like to be a paramedic in Kevin Hazard's new memoir, 1,000 Naked Strangers. Kevin joined us today on the show. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you. It was great to be on.
All right. That about does it for today's exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest